Peter B. Collins. News and comment for Wednesday, June 29th, 2016. We start with a quick programming note. Your humble host is taking a break to go visit Mom in the Midwest. Our next podcast here will be on July 12th. We open the podcast today with a little corporate rock from the band called Europe. And the song is The Final Countdown.
It's the final countdown.
With the winds of Brexit blowing worldwide, is it the final countdown for Europe and the European Union? Well, there's a lot of speculation going on, a lot of heated rhetoric. And we'll get to the situation in Britain in just a moment. But it is fair to say that the kind of anti-immigration and anti-globalism attitudes that surfaced in the Brexit referendum in England are quite alive and very active in other parts of the world, including many members of the European Union and right here in the good old U.S. of A. So Donald Trump gave a speech yesterday, and he's at least getting a little more presidential, where he is delivering speeches that have a script. They're not just a series of off-the-top-of-his-head talking points and insults. And he is staking out a position that appears to be well to the left and more populist than Hillary Clinton on trade policy. Now, we don't know exactly where Hillary stands, because she used to be in favor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and under pressure from the insurgent Bernie Sanders campaign, she shifted and said she's against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Then her appointed representatives to the Democratic National Committee's platform committee, they all said no to a proposal by Keith Ellison last Friday in St. Louis to have an explicit plank in the Democratic platform opposing Democratic votes for the TPP during the lame duck session and into next year. And why would Hillary's supporters want that wiggle room? Well, they said it's because they didn't want to insult President Obama. And it's about some notion of party unity. Well, if you remember, in June of 2008, Hillary supporters addressed party unity with the phrase PUMA, party unity my ass. And that's what comes to mind when I hear these claims, these lame claims. So Trump blasted both Bill and Hillary Clinton for their support for NAFTA, for other trade deals, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I don't know if Trump is even aware of the TTIP. That is the European version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. And it is not, I believe, fully negotiated, so it's not really in the pipeline at the same place as the TPP. But Trump is doing a very politically effective effort here by staking out a position that requires Hillary Clinton to defend her support of NAFTA and Bill's lobbying and signature on it. And it puts her in an awkward spot because she hasn't really explained fully what her positions on trade currently are. So Keith Ellison, a Sanders representative on that DNC platform committee, sent me and a million other people an email today saying that he needs your help. And I'm putting up a link to the petition that he has launched, asking the DNC to adopt a clear anti-TPP amendment when the full committee meets in Orlando on July 8th and 9th. So if you are a Democrat and you're so inclined, I encourage you to sign that petition and see if we get the Democratic Party in a clear oppositional position to the TPP. Now, this message about Brexit is clearly having a ripple effect. And one of the things is I do not claim to be an expert on the breakdown in the British electorate, but from my comfortable seat here, thousands of miles away, my impression is that there are many people who held their nose and voted to leave the European Union, and there are many people who held their nose and voted to stay. Because the issues of immigration and open borders are certainly alive and very, very sensitive in many countries right now. And those who've been on the losing end of globalization have honest questions about the continuation of some of these deals. So the European Union is putting pressure on Britain to move forward without delay and to exercise Article 50 in the Constitution of the European Union and begin their exit. And there is tough talk, which I think is not so much aimed at Britain, but aimed at the other 27 remaining members of the European Union. And that is that Britain can't expect to get the benefits of membership while skating on its obligations to the European Union. And so it's going to be, I think, a protracted and difficult negotiation as Angela Merkel, who really is the leader of the European Union, is going to try to make sure that Britain does suffer, that it loses status, it loses benefits by leaving the European Union. And she dismissed, along with David Cameron, the possibility that there might be a rerun of the referendum or that Parliament might fail to approve Article 50 and the actual withdrawal from the European Union. There are many additional steps here that have to be taken. And I've heard people who claim that the Brexit referendum was advisory. It's not necessarily binding on the Parliament. So there's a lot of maneuvering that remains to be done. But what I find interesting is that when you look across the European Union, and our only snapshot here is public opinion polling, but the Pew Research Center finds, for example, that the countries that get a net gain from being part of the European Union, such as Poland and Hungary, they have strong support there. And in, France, it's only 38% support for the European Union. In Spain, it's 47%. So across the entire Euro community, 48% say that they have an unfavorable view of the trading bloc. Now, this portends some serious problems going forward. Other countries may try to leave. Some may try to improve their bargaining position. And here's a voice of experience of European-imposed austerity from the country that probably should have left the European Union last year but didn't. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras of Greece arrived in Brussels for the meeting, and he described the British referendum result as a sad wake-up call that should force the European Union to abandon policies of austerity and endless negotiations behind closed doors. So my point here is that there are many origins, many sources of dissatisfaction, and it remains to be seen how political leaders will be able to deal with this, some responding defensively, some trying to operate in a proactive manner. And it's pretty clear to me that the virus is going to be a factor here in the United States, and that Hillary Clinton is quite vulnerable unless she comes out with clear positions. And this is the challenge that Bernie Sanders continues to pose to her, which is she wants to forget about the progressive voters in the primary who voted for Sanders. She wants to assume that 90% of those, as the polls are currently showing, will fall in line behind Hillary Clinton as the Democratic standard bearer. But that's not enough for her to win. She needs independent voters and conservative Democrats, and she needs some Republicans. And so Clinton's team is trying to position her more for the centrist position in November. And by trying to slough off issues like the TPP, I believe it creates greater vulnerabilities for Clinton that will be exploited by Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders is back in the Senate after being on the road for most of the past year. And he got right into the debate over the emergency bill for Puerto Rico. And because of the sit-in in the House last week and the early adjournment of the House, The only bill that the Senate can deal with is the bad PROMESA bill, PROMESA, that was voted through the House of Representatives. And it's an ugly bill. Sanders called it disastrous. Another referred to it as a form of colonial control of Puerto Rico. And the Democrats are over a barrel because with the next default scheduled to hit this Friday, July 1st, the clock has run and they're up against the wall. Now, this is one of the bad patterns of gridlock in Washington, where they repeatedly leave controversial issues until there's a critical deadline, and then they can ram through some really shitty legislation and say, look what we did there, aren't we great? Well, as Sanders has pointed out, the bill that is in process and is likely to clear the Senate as early as today, first and foremost protects the vulture capitalists who own the bond debt of the island of Puerto Rico. Then it also includes a measure that can lower the minimum wage for people who work in Puerto Rico. And it doesn't really provide any kind of a serious bailout. It simply attempts to renegotiate some of the terms of the debt over when to pay it, not so much how much is going to be paid. And even Bob Menendez, who is the crippled and corrupt senator from New Jersey, monopolized the Senate floor for more than 4 hours last evening, arguing that the bill adopted a colonial approach to the territory. He said ordinary Puerto Ricans got little say and that the package favored hedge fund creditors over island pensioners. Well, Menendez is correct about that, but it doesn't appear that the opponents have enough votes to stop this bad bill from becoming law. Hillary Clinton has made a proposal dealing with student debt. And this one I find really unusual and weird. Because, as you know, there was a significant difference between the Sanders position, which is free tuition at public colleges and universities, and the Clinton position, which was a vague promise to lower the debt load of America's college students. So yesterday she put forward a set of proposals, including one that would treat entrepreneurs and startup workers more favorably than other people with student debts. Now, the way it's spun, this is to break down barriers and level the playing field for entrepreneurs and innovators who are launching their own startups. It would allow startup founders to defer student debt payment for up to 3 years and would also be available to the company's first 10 or 20 employees. Now, this is the kind of effort that is targeted at the professional class, at the expense of working people and working families who want to send their kids to college. And Thomas Frank, who is a friend of this program, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, and most recently the book Listen Liberal, he's made the important case that the Democratic Party, starting with Bill Clinton's presidency in 92, shifted from representing the labor unions and working families, the middle class, to aiming at the professional class. And so this is quite consistent with the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC mentality that the Clintons brought to Washington. Now, this has real stinky issues of classism. What about the people who don't form a startup? What about the people who go to work for, you know, a community agency? What about artists? What about people who become accountants? I mean, to select a certain group of people and give them preferential treatment to student loan deferrals and perhaps even forgiveness of up to $18,000 after 5 years, this really sends the wrong message. And today at truthdig.com, another pal of mine, Bill Black, he teaches at the University of Kansas City. He's the guy who fought the savings and loan theft of the 1980s, and he put out a great effort this year to force candidates to deal with the Wall Street issues. Well, Bill Black wrote, "The terrible cost to Democrats and American society of ignoring Thomas Frank's warnings." And he talks about how Frank, in his new book, Listen Liberal, explains why the new Democrats' policies, the Clintons, which adopted traditional Republican policies, have been so destructive to labor, the working class, and the middle class. And Frank's books show how the contempt for new Democrats for the rest of us, the real core of the old Democratic Party, is quite palpable. I'm going to link to Bill Black's commentary and encourage you to check it out. The link is in the show file at peterbcollins.com. Every day I like to stop for a second and mention the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Faith Peoples, a staunch multiple offender here in our subscription department. Then Mark Sosnick just renewed his annual subscription. Thank you, Mark. Steve Wazinski, Aaron Blair, they're monthly subscribers. I encourage you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Maybe 10 new people could take out subscriptions while I'm on vacation. That'd be a wonderful thing to come back to. You click on the menu button, then you click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and that's where we display our bonus books. And you can choose from one of those three titles if you sign up for a brand-new annual subscription and supply me a mailing address in the continental U.S. Well, yesterday was another grisly event. Three, at least, so-called terrorists went into the airport in Istanbul. They fired weapons and killed some people, and then when they were confronted by authorities, they blew themselves up. And at this hour, at least 41 people are pronounced dead. Hundreds were wounded in this event. And the Turkish government immediately blamed the Islamic State. Now, it could be true. And the pattern of this attack is very similar to the one on the Brussels airport this past March. But the Kurdish population in Turkey has a lot of grievances with the government in Ankara. And in particular, as Erdogan has consolidated power in recent years, suppressed dissent, and then used the pretext of joining the American coalition to fight the Islamic State to crack down even more brutally on the Kurdish citizens of Turkey. Well, I think it is fair to speculate that the Kurds may have used this ugly process, this loss of life, of innocent life, to send a message to the Erdogan government. Now, we'll have to see how the investigation proceeds and see if there's any credible international observers to the investigation, or if this is going to be a job that will be handled from beginning to end by the Turkish authorities and therefore will not have any real credibility. And I just have to comment that I think it's truly sad that we are seeing so many of these kinds of attacks, and that there are too many people who are innocent victims caught in the crossfire, and that we are becoming numb to this. We haven't heard any stories this week about hundreds of refugees losing their lives on the Mediterranean as they flee the war zones. We've become numb to that. And I do have grave concerns that this numbness, that this acceptance of a new normal where people are killed on almost a daily basis, that we all really lose as that becomes commonplace. The United States Customs and Border Protection units have started asking people who come to our country who are not citizens and who do not have visas to disclose their social media accounts. And this is highly intrusive. Now, I do understand that people who visit our country do not enjoy constitutional rights, and I'm not trying to extend that to them. But if the U.S. becomes known as the country that will require visitors to cough up their social media accounts and maybe even their passwords, it raises questions. If I come through a border crossing and I give ICE my Facebook account name, do they need my password? Or do can they hack in there anyway? And is that just kind of meaningless? I don't know how much disclosure is being asked for right now. This is allegedly voluntary, but the plan is to make this mandatory at some time in the near future. And the question is, just how intrusive will we get? And does it really do any good? Are we just collecting more data that we can't manage? Spying on people who are largely innocent, hoping to find a single individual with bad intentions? And of course, once someone has shared their social media information with the U.S. government, will they then, you know, originate or receive any communications that could compromise them legally? Not if they're smart. There's a change of the guard in Tehran, and I can only report it. I can't tell you what drove it. But the man who has been the top general in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps since 1989, Hassan Firouzabadi, has been replaced by the Ayatollah Khamenei. His successor is his deputy chief of staff, General Mohammad Bagheri. And on June 16th, General Firouzabadi appointed a new set of advisors, and we're told he's been struggling with obesity and rumored to have undergone at least one operation to lose weight, and that health issues could be a reason for his dismissal. It really seems to me that if he's been there since 1989, they kind of know that he's overweight. So I just find it very strange that this is being offered as a possible reason for his being dumped. And he has been a very loyal supporter of the Ayatollah over the years. So perhaps this appointment of new advisors sent a red flag and caused the Ayatollah to say, oh no, get him out of there. We'll see if it has any impact as we monitor events going forward. Steve Horn has another great report at the Smog blog. He took a look at a report published last week by truthout.org and noticed that despite being quite newsworthy, no corporate media outlet had picked up this story. And the story is that the Obama administration has approved more than 1,500 permits, mostly secretly, for fracking in the Gulf of Mexico. And some of those permits were issued during the response to the Deepwater Horizon offshore spill a few years back. Now, the Obama administration, which wants to be the climate change team, has to explain why it has continued to allow these kinds of dangerous operations, not just offshore drilling, but offshore fracking. And we don't know exactly what happens, but it's quite likely that when they pump those cocktails of chemicals and sand into the bottom of the Gulf in order to change the geology below and release oil and gas deposits, that fracking wastewater is pumped out into tanks on the drilling platform, and then we believe that it is dumped right into the Gulf of Mexico. We know that some of the components of the cocktail that frackers use include benzene and other carcinogens. And so, while the Obama administration has operated with, great lip service to the environment and to climate change, at the very same time, it has been servicing the polluters and the carbon extractors who are, completely opposed to those policies. And finally today, a federal judge has ordered the city of Cleveland to relax some of its regulations regarding protesters and demonstrators at the Republican National Convention coming up later in July. The ACLU sued the city because of the restrictions on protests and marches, saying that it infringed on the right of free expression. So the Cleveland Board of Control finalized some of the new rules, which extended the parade route where activists can march, but they won't be able to go right to the Quicken Loans Arena. They will be able to march through areas around the arena that were previously off limits. Now, this seems to be a little bit of an improvement because in past years we've seen free speech zones, which were essentially just cages, fenced cages, that were set up for protesters, often well away from the scene of the action and with the kind of hardened security that is put in place at the facilities where the conventions take place. I experienced it in Denver in 2008. Well, the protesters really can't have their voices heard, and they're not within earshot or, visually in range of the people that they're trying to communicate with. So I'm glad to see that at least some modifications have been made in Cleveland. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. As I mentioned, I'll be back here on July the 12th. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.